Chapter 65. Strange oath that she would never willfully tempt him again. The pale and blasted nettle stems of the preceding year even now lingered nakedly in the banks, young green nettles of the present spring growing from their roots. Thence he went along the verge of the upland overhanging the other intocks, and, turning to the right, plunged into the bracing calcareous region of Flintcomb Ash, the address from which as he had written to him in one of the letters, and which he supposed to be the place of sojourn referred to by her mother. Here, of course, he did not find her, and what added to his depression was the discovery that no R.S. Clare had ever been heard of by the cottagers, or by the farmer himself, though Tess was remembered well enough by her Christian name. His name as he had obviously never used during their separation, and her dignified sense of their total severance was shown not much less by this abstention than by the hardships as he had chosen to undergo, of which he now learnt for the first time, rather than apply to his father for more funds. From this place they told him Tess Durbeyfield had gone, without due notice, to the home of her parents on the other side of Blackmoor, and it therefore became necessary to find Mrs. Durbeyfield. As he had told him, she was not now at Marlott, but had been curiously reticent as to her actual address, and the only course was to go to Marlott and inquire for it. The farmer who had been so churlish with Tess was quite smooth-tongued to Clare, and lent him a horse and man to drive him towards Marlott, the gig he had arrived in being sent back to Emminster, for the limit of a day's journey with that horse was reached. Clare would not accept the loan of the farmer's vehicle for a further distance than to the outskirts of the vale, and, sending it back with the man who had driven him, he put up at an inn, and next day entered on foot the region wherein was the spot of his dear Tess's birth. It was as yet too early in the year for much color to appear in the gardens and foliage. The so-called spring was but winter overlaid with a thin coat of greenness, and it was of a parcel with his expectations. The house in which Tess had passed the years of her childhood was now inhabited by another family who had never known her. The new residents were in the garden, taking as much interest in their own doings as if the homestead had never passed its primal time in conjunction with the histories of others, beside which the histories of these were but as a tale told by an idiot. They walked about the garden paths with thoughts of their own concerns entirely uppermost, bringing their actions at every moment in jarring collision with the dim ghosts behind them, talking as though the time when Tess lived there were not one whit intenser in story than now. Even the spring birds sang over their heads, as if they thought there was nobody missing in particular. On inquiry of these precious innocents, to whom even the name of their predecessors was a failing memory, Clare learned that John Durbeyfield was dead, that his widow and children had left Marlott, declaring that they were going to live at Kingsmere, but instead of doing so had gone on to another place they mentioned. By this time Clare abhorred the house for ceasing to contain Tess, and hastened away from its hated presence without once looking back. His way was by the field in which he had first beheld her at the dance. It was as bad as the house, even worse. He passed on through the churchyard, where, amongst the new headstones, he saw one of a somewhat superior design to the rest. The inscription ran thus: "In memory of John Durbeyfield, rightly D'Urberville, of the once powerful family of that name, and direct descendant through an illustrious line from Sir Pagan D'Urberville, one of the knights of the Conqueror. Died March 10th, 18 hour the mighty fallen." Some man, apparently the sexton, had observed Clare standing there, and drew nigh. "H, sir, now that's a man who didn't want to lie here, but wished to be carried to Kingsmere, where his ancestors be. And why didn't they respect his wish? Oh, no money. Bless your soul, sir, why there, I wouldn't wish to say it everywhere, but even this headstone, for all the flourish wrote upon N, is not paid for. Ah, who put it up? The man told the name of a mason in the village, and, on leaving the churchyard, Clare called at the mason's house. He found that the statement was true, and paid the bill. This done, he turned in the direction of the migrants. The distance was too long for a walk, but Claire felt such a strong desire for isolation that at first he would neither hire a conveyance nor go to a circuitous line of railway by which he might eventually reach the place. At Shaston, however, he found he must hire, but the way was such that he did not enter Jones' place till about 7 o'clock in the evening, having traversed a distance of over 20 miles since leaving Marlott. The village being small, he had little difficulty in finding Mrs. Derbyfield's tenement, which was a house in a walled garden, remote from the main road, whereas he had stowed away her clumsy old furniture as best she could. It was plain that for some reason or other as he had not wished him to visit her, and he felt his call to be somewhat of an intrusion. She came to the door herself, and the light from the evening sky fell upon her face. This was the first time that Claire had ever met her, but he was too preoccupied to observe more than that she was still a handsome woman, in the garb of a respectable widow. He was obliged to explain that he was Tess's husband, and his object in coming there, and he did it awkwardly enough. "Want to see her at once," he added. "Who said you would write to me again, but you have not done so?" "Because she've not come home," said Joan. "Do you know if she is well?"
"I don't."
"But you ought to, sir," said she.
"I admit it."
"Where is she staying?" From the beginning of the interview, Joan had disclosed her embarrassment by keeping her hand to the side of her cheek. "I don't know exactly where she is staying," she answered. "As she was, but where was she?"
"Well, she is not there now."
In her evasiveness she paused again, and the younger children had by this time crept to the door, where, pulling at his mother's skirts, the youngest murmured, "Is this the gentleman who is going to marry Tess?"
"He has married her," Joan whispered.
"Oh, inside." Claire saw her efforts for reticence, and asked, "Do you think Tess would wish me to try and find her? If not, of course, I don't think she would."
"Are you sure?"
"I am sure she wouldn't." He was turning away, and then he thought of Tess's tender letter.
"I am sure she would," he retorted passionately.
"I know her better than you do."
"That's very likely, sir, for I have never really known her."
"Please tell me her address, Mrs. Derbyfield, in kindness to a lonely wretched man." Tess's mother again restlessly swept her cheek with her vertical hand, and seeing that he suffered, she at last said, in a low voice, "She is at Sandburn."
"Ah, where there?"
"Sandburn has become a large place, they say."
"I don't know more particularly than I have said Sandburn.
For myself, I was never there." It was apparent that Joan spoke the truth in this, and he pressed her no further.
"Are you in want of anything?"
he said gently.
"No, sir," she replied.
"We are fairly well provided for." Without entering the house, Claire turned away. There was a station 3 miles ahead, and paying off his coachman, he walked thither. The last train to Sandburn left shortly after, and it bore Claire on its wheels. L.V., at 11 o'clock that night, having secured a bed at one of the hotels, and telegraphed his address to his father immediately on his arrival, he walked out into the streets of Sandburn. It was too late to call on her inquiry for anyone, and he reluctantly postponed his purpose till the morning. But he could not retire to rest just yet. This fashionable watering place, with its eastern and its western stations, its piers, its groves of pines, its promenades, and its covered gardens, was, to Angel Claire, like a fairy place suddenly created by the stroke of a wand, and allowed to get a little moldy. An outlying eastern tract of the enormous Egdon Waste was close at hand, yet on the very verge of that tawny piece of antiquity such a glittering novelty as this pleasure city had chosen to spring up. Within the space of a mile from its outskirts, every irregularity of the soil was prehistoric, every channel an undisturbed British trackway, not a sod having been turned there since the days of the Caesars. Yet the exotic had grown here, suddenly as the prophet scored, and had drawn hither Tess.
By the midnight lamps he went up and down the winding way of this new world in an old one, and could discern between the trees, and against the stars the lofty roofs, chimneys, gazebos, and towers of the numerous fanciful residences, of which the place was composed. It was a city of detached mansions, a Mediterranean lounging place on the English Channel, and as seen now by night it seemed even more imposing than it was. The sea was near at hand, but not intrusive. It murmured, and he thought it was the pines. The pines murmured in precisely the same tones, and he thought they were the sea. Where could Tess possibly be, a cottage girl, his young wife, amidst all this wealth and fashion? The more he pondered, the more was he puzzled. Were there any cows to milk here? There certainly were no fields to till. She was most probably engaged to do something in one of these large houses, and he sauntered along, looking at the chamber windows and their lights going out one by one, and wondered which of them might be hers. Conjecture was useless, and just after 12 o'clock he entered and went to bed. Before putting out his light he reread Tess's impassioned letter. Sleep, however, he could not so near her, yet so far from her, and he continually lifted the window blind, and regarded the backs of the opposite houses, and wondered behind which of the sashes she reposed at that moment. He might almost as well have sat up all night. In the morning he arose at 7, and shortly after went out, taking the direction of the chief post office. At the door he met an intelligent postman coming out with letters for the morning delivery. "Do you know the address of a Mrs. Clare?" asked Angel. The postman shook his head. Then, remembering that she would have been likely to continue the use of her maiden name, Clare said, "Of a Miss Derbyfield?" "Derbyfield?" This also was strange to the postman addressed. "There's visitors coming and going every day, as you know, sir," he said, "and without the name of the house 'tis impossible to find them." One of his comrades hastening out at that moment, the name was repeated to him. "I know no name of Derbyfield, but there is the name of D'Urberville at the Herons," said the second. "That's it," cried Clare, pleased to think that as he has reverted to the real pronunciation. Hat places the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.